Welcome to Just Now Possible with Teresa Torres.
I'm Ellen Brandenberger. I am a product leader and coach. I previously was head of product for Chegg Skills, which is the post-secondary arm of Chegg, where I led product management, design, and research. But most recently was at Stack Overflow, where I led the product management for the data licensing team there at Stack. If you think about Stack Overflow, most people know us or knew the business for essentially its public platform, right? Millions of developers, questions and answers on the site. So my team is really focused, at least recently, on thinking about how do we build AI products and services for the AI era? And then how could Stack Overflow community knowledge be useful to companies building AI? And what would that look like to actually build products for those users, right? So my team was often at the forefront of asking those questions and thinking about how we bring new products to market in that area. So that's my background as well.
Yeah, and if I remember right, you started at Stack Overflow like right before ChatGPT came out. So you're obviously your role was heavily influenced by ChatGPT, big impact on Stack Overflow. And I think a lot of your work was in this very urgent, what is this new future that's being created? Is that fair?
Yeah, I like to say, it's a bit of a joke, but I like to say that I joined 2 weeks before ChatGPT came out. So the world pre and post ChatGPT at Stack Overflow looked really different.
Okay, so we're going to get into this. I think what I love about your story is that I think everybody is feeling the pressure of like, how is AI impacting our lives? I think you got to experience that from day one when ChatGPT came out. And I think a lot of people can probably learn from your experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's certainly a lot of lessons along that journey that I'll take with me for a long time in my career. It's a good one to start talking about as well.
Yeah, those are always the best, the way we grow. Okay, so let's get into this. I understand that over your time at Stack Overflow, there's sort of two AI products we're going to get into, kind of how they came about, how they evolved, what happened with them. Do you want to just set the scene for the first one? Give me a little bit of context about what was going on at Stack Overflow. Where did the idea come from?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing I want to talk about is a conversational AI slash search feature that we built. I think it was called Conversational Search. But I think to go back to the original context here, we just talked about this. ChatGPT came out, started to force a lot of questions in the industry about, does AI belong in my products? Where does it fit? And I would say most leaders within the industry were either asking their teams that, asking themselves that, or getting that set of questions from their investors. So at Stack, that manifested in really quickly. I would say we were one of the first in that space. So this is back in early 2023, developers started to change their workflows. One of the things we saw very quickly at Stack was sometimes questions that would typically be asked on Stack Overflow were starting to be asked of AI, right? And didn't necessarily mean that users didn't eventually end up on Stack Overflow, but those workflows were at least changing. And so the Stack leadership team felt really strongly that not just that we needed to embed AI, but we needed to think about what was now possible in a way that was new. So they actually tasked me and a few other engineering leaders with building a team that was essentially called Overflow AI, for lack of a better phrase. Internally, we had a different code name, but that team was essentially tasked with learning about what are the opportunities or jobs to be done within our products that we don't have good solutions for today that AI might help us unlock. So yes, we did start with the solution a little bit, but it was also about learning about this new technology. Like, how is it going to change workflows? What solutions could we offer our customers and our users that were net new that didn't previously exist?
Yeah. Let me pause you for just a second, because I realize we might have some listeners that are not super familiar with Stack Overflow. Yeah. So I want to just give a little bit of context of Stack Overflow's primary product. It's almost like a community forum where people ask questions, very strong in engineering questions. So how do I do this thing in this code? I'm trying to do this. I'm stuck. And then the community responds. And like Quora, like Reddit, people can vote up answers. People build reputations on Stack Overflow from their answers. And it really, like, for a very long time, was the first place engineers went when they had a question they wanted answered. Yeah. Is that a fair summary?
That's a fair summary. I often, like, when people ask me what I do, I often say I work on the Reddit for developers or software.
Yeah, perfect.
And that's a great, like, sort of one-liner for folks to help them understand. I'd also add that, like, community participation in asking and answering technical questions is a very specific workflow and comes with a lot of cultural norms, right? There's a strong culture of what a good question looks like, what a good answer looks like. And there's also a strong culture of participation. What is it appropriate to comment? How is it appropriate to vote? And so we had this sort of like rich corpus of technical knowledge that was built up.
I also want to highlight, like, historically, I actually, people may not be aware of this, but like, I think with engineering questions and answers, I'm even thinking back to 2000, maybe even 1999, like the beginning of Slashdot. And like Slashdot was also this like very engineering heavy site where people could post stories. People eventually started posting questions. And I feel like Stack Overflow became the modern day Slashdot, not from the news sharing standpoint, that's probably Hacker News, but from the community piece. And I think this is a really important part of the Stack Overflow story because I think engineers, developers live their lives online, and like Stack Overflow found a way to capture that audience and really be the place they connected with each other and shared knowledge with each other. And it wasn't the first iteration, right? Like, it was the home of this has evolved over time. But for quite some time, Stack Overflow has been the primary destination for these types of things. And then I think with the release of ChatGPT, it was a really big deal to see this, even if it started as a small shift of, oh, engineer behavior is changing. And so I want to just make sure people are aware, like, this was a bit like a cataclysmic event for Stack Overflow, right?
Yep. Very disruptive. But also, if you think about it, 90, I forget the exact number, but it's 90 plus percent of developers use Stack Overflow on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, if I wear a Stack Overflow t-shirt to the grocery store, five people will stop me and tell me they're a developer and they use the site frequently. So it's very well known.
I think this is why I equate it a little bit with Slashdot. It's not that they had similar functionality. They're just both really beloved brands. And like the people identify with it. And I think if you're not an engineer, you may not really be aware of that connection. And so I think what's part really interesting about your story and why I'm excited to get into these products is that like you see this really disruptive moment, which is in some ways terrifying, but also opens the door to a huge opportunity. And I love that you're already framing this as there was this team put together to discuss, okay, this is a huge change, but what's just now possible?
Yeah. And so like, I would say there's also quite a few teams that I think out there were quite terrified. And instead, like the reaction was like, oh, things are changing. Like, how do we wrap our arms around this? What could the future look like that it isn't possible today? Or we do know that we have this strong community and this strong brand, right? That's not going to evaporate overnight. And so how do we leverage the things that we do really well and continue to serve that audience? And so that was really the frame for this team at the time.
Okay. And then you talked about, yes, you had a technology in mind, maybe not specific solutions, but, and this is, I think, a really common theme that's popping up is people are asking, what's just now possible? That's the name of the podcast, right? Like it's a very timely technology. It's really disrupting everything. And so I think everybody is stopping and asking this question, but it does also look like you looked at it from a customer standpoint of what are we doing for our customers that we could now do better given this technology. So tell me a little bit about what that looked like.
Yeah, so it took a variety of forms. So one was like we had enterprise customers that were starting to say, would it mean Stack also has a product called Stack Overflow for Teams, which is an enterprise tool. That's basically think about a version of Stack Overflow, but just for your company. Yeah. So it's about your code base. It's about the internal questions on your roadmap, things like that. And so many of those customers were starting to ask us, they had proprietary access to their own data within those instances. And so many of them started to come to us and say, hey, can I combine this data with this large language model that just came out? I think ChatGPT-4 is like the right answer, but I don't know. And that was one angle. The other angle was like, one of the things that we'd seen developers really struggle with was there's often multiple right answers to different questions, but one answer in one context was more likely to be helpful or contextually correct for them, right? For example, Python 7.0 versus 8.0, right? Mm. What's right in one version isn't necessarily right in the other. And how do you identify the right context of a needed answer instead of just giving the generic most popular answer, right? The other is thinking about bias or time recency, right? Stack Overflow has a strong inner reputation system, and in our user analytics, we have a strong system reputation of leaning towards older answers were better because they had more votes, they'd accrued more votes and comments from our community over time. But sometimes the more recent answer was more relevant to the user when trying to find a solution. And so in all three of those cases, AI helped us think about new ways to identify the right context, identify combining context from different sources, or to think about when is the age of an answer versus the recency of an answer more important. So those are all some different use cases we were playing around with. There were definitely
So funny. Even just that, what you just shared starts to uncover some of the complexity. Like I could think about Stack Overflow very simply. Someone asks a question, the community answers it. But you're already starting to expose. But if the question is missing context, people don't answer it well. Or maybe the question has context, but people are answering from a different context and it's not the best answer in that moment. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit of like, how do you get the person asking the question to share the right context? How do you make sure the person answering the question understands the context and their answer matches for that context? So I love that, like, you, even just a little bit you've gotten into, we can already start to see some of this complexity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about what were your, like, the very early days of, okay, we might do something with AI. Did you prototype stuff? Did you just brainstorm ideas?
So actually what the teams did, so I think there were about five different sort of like product engineering and design pods working on this project at the time. So what we did is myself and the engineering leader, we set up a structure where weekly the teams would report on their experiments with AI and share how things went. And each of those teams had a little bit of a sort of scoped outcomes area, right? Some were working on user activation, some were working on user retention, some were working on more on the enterprise facing side of the business. And weekly, they would actually try things out. They would do everything from plugging into a model and writing a code extension to, I think one time a team did an evaluation of what makes a good answer, right? And then they'd share those reports out on a weekly basis. And sometimes that actually meant they went deeper on one of those areas if they saw either technical signal that something was working and possible, or if they saw a user signal that something was valuable, right? And other times they would determine this looks fun, but it's not actually that valuable once we get our hands on it. And they would pivot. So I think there was a slide I remember, it was quite popular, that I made, which was essentially like all the experiments that had happened in a like 3-month period. And it's probably, I think it has maybe 50 lines on it, right? They're all just like in small typeface with 2-word names, and they got reused over and over again to show the scale of what the teams were trying out.
Yeah. You know what I love about this is like, what you're describing is just the regular discovery process. Like it's, the fundamentals don't really change. Like you had a bunch of teams, they each had their own outcomes, they were each exploring and running a ton of experiments and just looking for what might work. And then you created rituals for them to come and share with each other, which is exactly what we teach at Product Talk for how do you solve open-ended problems. So I love that, like, it's really easy to think like everything radically changes with this new technology, but it turns out the same core principles can help us get there.
Yeah. The other part that was super fun, and this kind of came up organically, was the team started recording their demos, and then they started getting passed around on Slack. And when there was a particularly good demo, the teams would get like a lot of props across the organization, even outside product. We had to be careful. Obviously, those weren't shared explicitly with customers, but we needed to, but it made it really fun. right? It made like the failing and the trying really fun and really public in a way that I wouldn't necessarily have to repeat back all the experiments the teams were running as the product leader. They got to do it for themselves and get the kudos as well. So
that's amazing. Okay, this actually sounds really, I'm sure it was stressful at the time because everything felt really urgent, but it also sounds really fun, right? Like a lot of teams just experimenting, sharing what they're learning. Tell me a little bit about what was the transition to like, how did you know you had something that was worth investing in? Like, how did this first product come about?
Yeah, and the first product that I'm going to talk about, and this wasn't like the most successful in the sum of experiments that I just talked about, but I think it's most relevant to this conversation. So one of the teams was working on what we called activation. So Stack Overflow, for those of you who aren't familiar, there's a bit of a joke among developers that the user experience for Stack Overflow is actually a Google search, right? So that you actually go to Google, and we do very well on SEO and other sort of like social ranking systems. And so that you kind of land on a question page that comes up through your Google search and you go right there. And we had some analytics that the first thing that comes up for users in Google search, it wasn't necessarily always the most contextualized or specific answer for users. And so this team is really focused on activation. How do you get users to do anything after they visit that first page? And I say anything because our site's actually, from a user experience perspective, not that complex, but from a community perspective and a technical perspective, it's quite complex under the hood. What the team basically uncovered was, what are some ways that we could get users to take multiple actions, right? So they built this hypothesis through interviews where they basically found like, it's pretty easy for me to land on a page as a developer, but if the answer is not quite right, where do I go next? Do I usually try to search at the top of Stack Overflow? And that doesn't always give me the experience that I want, right? Sometimes I have to search with keywords, or sometimes I have to search in a very specific way, or sometimes I click on related questions on the page nav, or there was multiple paths out of that page, but none of them are really solving for that opportunity very well. So the team narrowed in on, let's build a kind of conversational search experience, right? Because the other problem that they were starting to hear was, if I ask a question on Stack Overflow, which was often an off-ramp for users, it takes me a couple days to get an answer. And when I'm comparing that to a tool like ChatGPT, the ChatGPT may give me an answer that's a little bit less good, but it gives me an answer a lot faster. So they're solving for two things, which is the quality of the answer and the speed at which you get an answer.
So let me make sure I understand this. Like the first use case is I go to Google, I type something in, I click on the first result, it's Stack Overflow. The question doesn't quite match my context. And really the burden is on me to fix it. So like I have to now type a new query in the search box to like better match my context. Yeah. And that requires a lot of like, first of all, I have to be aware of why this answer wasn't the best fit. And it's a little bit, I think, almost analogous to like why LLMs are stronger than search in a lot of use cases. Right. If I go to Google and I type in something and I don't get the best result, it's on me to modify my search keywords and guess what's a better way to get there. Whereas in ChatGPT, it feels a lot more conversational. I can just be like, no, I need to give you this missing context. And I don't really have to think about it. It's like talking to a person. And then I get immediate feedback. Is this the right thing or not?
Yeah.
So it sounds like there was like this desire of let's create that same conversational experience on Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
And then it had the added benefit of if you're going to ask a question,
you have an
option. You're coming to Stack Overflow to ask a question. You now can also get an immediate answer instead of having to wait for the community to respond.
Yeah. Or if that doesn't even work, could you ask a question on Stack Overflow? Like having multiple off ramps to the same user input at the top of the funnel.
Okay. So it sounds like this team had found like a pretty clear customer problem of I'm landing on an answer. It doesn't really meet my needs. I'm guessing they bounced at some point, or maybe they tried other things, but they were just getting stuck.
Right. Tabs open, which is often what we see in our analytics. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what did they do? What was their early prototype?
Yeah. So initially their thinking was like, let's build a chatbot or like a user conversational agent. So what they did first was, what would it look like if you essentially had a conversational agent that answered questions in real time, and you could give it additional question context based on Stack Overflow's giant corpus of technical knowledge instead of just purely like an AI model, right? Yep. So they started looking at that first. What they initially tested, and this was a team that, like, for context, this is a PM, right? A designer and a tech lead, very engaged tech lead who like really wanted, as a developer, this person really wanted to know, how's the site working? What will this work for developers? Can I try it out? So that was a benefit that we had, which is that developers at Stack Overflow are users of the product. And while it can lead to pitfalls, in this case, I think was great because he was very engaged with the testing. But they started, we had a variety of internal services, right? A search endpoint, other platform capabilities that allowed us to basically allowed the team to put a very simple interface on top of that and just ask technical questions of the Stack Overflow corpus. And pretty quickly, I would say within a day or two, the team figured out that the answers they were getting were not sufficient. So much like the search bar, where they were, you had to know the specific way to ask a question, they realized that you're getting the same result from just looking at Stack Overflow. There are a couple of iterations, and I'm happy to speak to that too.
Let me ask about that very first implementation. Are you familiar with the technical details of what they did?
Not as much as I probably would have been a year ago, but
okay. Here's what I'm curious about. You're talking about a chat agent, and today, like in 2025, we talk about agents as like LLMs that have the autonomy to call different tools.
I'm going to say this is the V1, right?
Yeah. So I'm guessing, like, when you say agent, you really are talking about the little chat interface we all grew to love because it was everywhere. Right. I'm assuming there wasn't tool calling.
There wasn't tool calling. Yeah.
What I'm curious about is, like, how did you integrate Stack Overflow content? Was there a trained model on Stack Overflow content? Was there like a RAG system in place? Do you remember?
So essentially we had at that point, we had a lexical search engine, which was essentially ranking relevance of content. So this piece of content is like this piece of content.
So it was a chat interface on top of your search box.
Exactly.
Okay. Which explains why it got very similar results as your search box.
Yeah. So like the end result is pretty much to be expected.
Yeah.
That actually led to one insight, which is the team decided, in working with our platform teams at Stack, there's a separate platform group that works to build services across the organization. That led to some pretty quick feedback that a lexical model might be more relevant. For those who don't know, lexical search is essentially more human, a more simple way to describe this is the queries can be more human-like, right? More like prompts, more conversational, more oriented towards questions instead of keywords, right?
Yeah. So the first version was built on keyword search, which I know a lot of people, this is exactly where they start. So I love this evolution of, it's almost like that first product, the experiment is, does a chat interface get people to enter better keywords?
Right.
And like in this case, the answer was no. Like it wasn't, they entered some stuff, it still got not very good results. So then the next evolution was like, okay, can we augment our search to be better at these sort of conversational queries?
Right. Yeah. So that was V2. And the team saw some better results, right? You could put in a question instead of keywords and get a better answer. But there were still gaps in our corpus of knowledge. It was only pulling from Stack Overflow. And the minute a question veered out of the technical knowledge base that we had, which happened pretty quickly, the product was still limited. So V3, I guess you could call it now, started to look like, how do you combine external models with the AI corpus? So they actually implemented the semantic search model in combination with a backup to, I think, GPT-4, which was the sort of the premier model at the time in early 2023.
And was that like just a fallback? Like you would try to answer it with Stack Overflow, and if you couldn't, you kicked it out to
GPT-4? Right. Yeah.
Okay.
What that actually looked like from a user experience perspective was similar to an Intercom or other sort of early 2020s conversational chat. But we found a couple other things that were specifically relevant to Stack Overflow, right? So one is that developers have really high expectations of validation and quality of answers, right? Perhaps even higher than your average user of a consumer product. And it was very important. And Stack Overflow actually does a developer survey every year, which is tens of thousands of developers answering questions about trust in AI. And what we typically find is that as use of AI goes up, trust goes down. So there was this, what we started calling it, the trust gap, right? The gap between use and trust in developers was increasingly growing.
How do you measure that?
So we had two questions on the survey. How frequently are you using AI in your day-to-day work? And then how much do you trust AI? I think it was a scale of 1 to 4.
Okay.
And basically take the first number minus the second number. And that's the trust gap. Pretty simple. Really helpful in orienting like the difference between expectations and reality for most folks. Yeah. So yeah, we took that, and then we basically found out that like attribution was a really important component. And I know this sounds a little technical, but essentially linking sources to actually understand where an answer came from and that AI was included, right, was really important for creating transparency for developers, right? So they were much more able to trust the answer if they knew where it came from.
So if I'm using the conversational interface and you give me an answer, I want to know, are you pulling this from a community response? And if so, maybe who in the community?
Right.
Are you pulling it from ChatGPT? Did you see a difference? Do people trust community responses more than GPT, or do they trust GPT more?
They tended to, right?
Okay.
The trouble, though, there is that typically an answer would blend sources, multiple questions and answers, or multiple sources from across Stack Overflow and the AI. So it's more a proportional attribution than it is holistic. Typically, unless you ask a very specific question.
Yeah.
So it tends in that direction. It's a bit hard to prove.
And what, like, how did this look to the end user? Did they get a source that told them this came from a mix of the community and AI?
So the tricky part about attribution is you actually, with a lot of that, you do actually have to start to implement RAG services on top of your semantic layer, right? So you have to. And for those who don't know what RAG is, retrieval augmented generation is essentially taking the vectorized data from your semantic search and essentially retrieving bits and pieces of an answer and then re-aggregating it for your end users in ways that make the most sense.
Yeah, let's put this a little bit in like simpler terms. For people that are used to using an LLM, like in your web browser, and you're typing a prompt, all RAG does is it allows you to pull in other data into that prompt. So in this case, in your conversational UI, the user enters their question. Your system is looking at that question, going to your vector database and saying, what do we have in our knowledge store that is related to this? And then adding that to the prompt. So when the LLM responds, it doesn't just get the user's query. It gets all the related knowledge related to that query. And then it can respond with, here's what I think the best answer is.
That's a much simpler way to put it. I love it. So actually, I think I've lost track of version numbers now, but I think we're at version 4.
Okay.
Essentially, version 4 was actually implementing some element of RAG to then list out the sources that were included in the answer.
And was that like the goal of that, so that you could provide that transparency? Was your search was providing the right responses? It's you weren't adding RAG to improve the quality of the search. You were adding RAG to know where the answers were coming from.
Yeah, that was the initial thinking at very least. Since then, Stack has evolved to do both, but it's really the thinking there.
One thing I want to highlight about this story so far is that I know a lot of teams like hear all these terms thrown around. We should use RAG. We should use MCP. We should have agents and tools. And almost every real story that I've collected from teams, they literally started with the simplest thing they could do. Let's just throw a chatbot on top of our keyword search. Okay, that broke. Let's replace keyword search with semantic search. Okay, that was better, but we ran into this specific obstacle. Let's add RAG to solve that problem. And I think this is a really important thing to highlight because it's so easy to get caught up in all the buzzwords and the technology. And really, like, it's about how do you get something live so you can learn where the edges are and then use the technology to address those edges rather than out of the gate being like, we're going to use RAG, we're going to use MCP, we're going to have an autonomous agent with 17 tools. Like, you just don't know what's going to work until you start putting it in front of customers.
Yeah. And I would say as we were going, the team was learning what those technologies were.
Yeah.
My team was not experts in any of these things. And so we would have like lunch and learns on Fridays where someone would bring up an article that they read about a new technology. And they would be like, great, can we apply this? Where could we apply it? And I think there's also a good lesson here about making it okay to learn as you go versus feeling like you need to master the technology in order to adopt it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is really equivalent to my personal experience. Like I tried to build my interview coach. I got very overwhelmed. There's so much you have to learn to even start making decisions. Yeah. And so I think what it forced me to do was just to start prototyping. And it sounds like that's almost what your team did too, is let's just see what we can try. And in a lot of ways, this makes me really excited because I think it's going to force people into prototyping more. It's augmenting a fundamental principle that we've always known, but maybe weren't always good at doing. And now all the overwhelm is like forcing us, like, what can we do right now based on what we know? Let's just do that. And then we can evolve it over time.
Yeah. And that overwhelm can be real, right?
Yeah, for sure.
The piece of advice I always gave to my team was, think about ways you can time box your learning and your experimentation. And while that may sound counterintuitive on the face, it actually makes it simpler at the root, right? You're essentially saying, like, what bite of the apple can I take first? And I just start there. And then I take the next one and the next one and the next one until
I love this. It's so one of the things I always have in my head is like, how do I limit how much new I need to learn right now? Like, I always want to be learning something new and like progressing, but I don't want to be overwhelmed. And so what's the most urgent thing that I love to take one bite of the apple at a time? That's a great analogy.
Yeah. Okay. It's also why we thought about learning in week steps and not month or 2 weeks. It wasn't so much about speed so much as what can we just do next?
Such a great continuous mindset. Okay, so we've heard about 4 iterations. Here's what I'm curious about. Did every iteration get put in front of customers? How did you evaluate what good looked like? Like, how did you know to go from V1 to V2 to V3?
Yeah. So the short answer is not every iteration got put in front of customers. Those first 2 where we were literally a search box, we did some internal validation with other developers and subject matter experts about the quality of answers. V3 and V4, as we started to include AI and RAG, did get released to a beta set of customers. I remember we essentially did a limited launch. I think there was a wait list of about 1,000 users. And those folks were typically already Stack Overflow community members across the broad variety of subject matter areas. And that's important because while Stack Overflow is largely developer focused, there's quite a large breadth of knowledge that's on the site. Everything from data scientists and analytics to folks that work in front-end engineering to DevOps and deployment. And so each of those areas has their own sort of depth and expertise. And so we wanted to build a user base that was semi-representative of the diversity of our corpus. And the team did a few evaluations of the service. So I remember it was pretty simplistic, right? We're talking Google spreadsheets where I was calculating percentages of correctness with a simple mathematical formula, nothing crazy. But essentially we took a couple approaches. One is There, we actually asked subject matter experts in key domains to ask and then rate answers that they got as correct or incorrect. And then we just looked at pure percentages, what percentage were correct in each domain. I think we maybe tested 300 questions, so it wasn't massive, but we were testing enough that we were getting an idea. We started to get an idea of how, what percentage of answers were correct coming from the chat.
Okay, I want to dig into this a little bit because, like, literally everybody starts in spreadsheets, and I really want to know what went in the spreadsheet. So it sounds like you had a small beta population. You asked them to ask questions. Were you logging that somewhere?
Yeah, so we were keeping a log of all the questions they asked in each chat record. Yeah.
Okay, and then were you also logging the LLM response?
We were, yeah.
Okay, so you have a spreadsheet of the question, the LLM response, and I assume how the user rated the response.
Rated the response, correct.
And then you went in and were just like, were you, I'm assuming you just started with like percent that were rated thumbs up or whatever.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
And then I grouped them by, we have these things called tags on Stack Overflows. And they're essentially typically programming languages or areas of expertise. Yep. That our community assigns. So I was grouping the percentages by tag. So like Python, front end, DevOps.
So then you could see, is it good in some categories, not in other categories? Okay, you know what I love about this? Okay, so when I first learned about evals, I did not know what they were. Everybody talked about these spreadsheets. They talked about like inputs and outputs and like ideal outputs. And I got really confused because I was like, how do I define the ideal output? My end user needs to define the ideal output, not me. And so I love that you integrated. I know there are some instances where you can define 2 plus 2 is 4. That is the ideal output. But like for anything subjective, it's a little bit hard as a product manager. It's a little bit hard to do that out of the gate. And I love that you built in customer feedback from day one. Let's let the customer tell us, was this helpful or not? And that's a pattern we see everywhere now, but I want to highlight like how early this was. Like, I love just the focus on, we don't have to have all the answers. Let's let the customer give us the answer.
Yeah. And even in some cases, actually most cases, I'm not a software engineer. I've never been a software engineer.
Yeah.
So I couldn't tell you if the answer was correct. And so that was freeing in the sense that finding users who could tell us whether that was correct or not correct was almost a necessity.
Yeah.
And so having that engaged audience was really a good forcing function for us. Yeah.
Okay. And then tell me a little bit about what did you do with this data? Like, obviously you counted to get a sense for like, how good is this? But did you dig into the thumbs down? What did you learn from digging into your data?
Yeah. Essentially the product manager, there was also a researcher working with the team and a designer. And we did see particular domains like Python do better or worse. And the researcher on the team actually sat down with subject matter experts in our community, so our end users, who rated answers as either more correct than others or less correct than others, and asked the same set of research questions to both groups on why they gave the ratings they did, and then compared and found themes between the highest answers and the lowest answers as points of contrast. That was one method. And then the other was we looked at logs, right? As you just mentioned. And particularly, we were looking for a couple of things. It wasn't just the eval, but it was also things like trust and safety, right? Stack Overflow is quite a high scale site. We have millions of users every single day. And so that also means we need heavy moderation and heavy trust and safety practices. And we need healthy guardrails for what answers we do and don't allow. We were looking for logs that essentially breached those things according to various patterns that we had. We were also looking for instances where that were either false positives or false negatives. A false positive may look like it's technically correct, but it's not correct for this version.
Yeah.
And a false negative might look like it's technically correct, but I prefer this other method, right? Yeah. And that is a very common sentiment, again, among developers, of preference versus correctness or relevance versus correctness. And I actually had a hypothesis that we should start breaking out accuracy, relevance, and completeness. We ran scores through that lens as well, which helped us better understand and differentiate between the different ratings within
Yeah, I love this because I feel like there's, especially in the eval space now, we're getting vendors that have these off the shelf like metrics. And they don't, evals are so specific to your use case. So even just your conversation about accuracy versus relevance versus completeness, those feel like the same thing, but in your case, they're clearly not. Sure. And we recorded it. I recorded an episode with somebody from Arise, which is one of the eval companies. And she said on the, in the interview that they do start with off the shelf evals, but they're really meant to be templates. They're to help people get started and that they definitely advocate we need use case specific evals. And I was so happy to hear that because I feel like if we want quality products, we have to do, I love that even on your very first AI product, you looked at your data, you started to do error analysis. That error analysis led to, we need to get much more specific on how we measure quality. So even though like you were just learning, it sounds like you did a lot of the right things from day one.
Yeah, and that might just be luck. I will also say that prior to working in product, my background is as a qualitative researcher, right? Yeah. So a lot of that thinking of like, how do we categorize data? How do we find patterns in unstructured data? That is my bread and butter. And I think I was maybe subconsciously in retrospect, kind of applying those research methods to a lot of this work. Yeah.
This is a theme that's coming up a lot. A lot of us, even if we have never built LLM apps, we do have skills that we can already apply, whether that's qualitative research skills or data science skills or machine learning skills. And I actually think this is a really important thing to emphasize is that, yes, we're in a whole new world, but that whole new world is connected to our old world. And so we all bring skills that can make this easier.
It's built on the foundation of the old world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've been through four iterations of conversational search. What happened next?
Yeah, I'll wrap this one a little bit. But ultimately, what we found is that even with the four iterations of conversational search, we still weren't, and even with starting to break down what quality and accuracy meant, we still weren't getting to even 70% accuracy in answer, which, if you remember a couple of minutes ago, I spoke about developers have very high expectations of accuracy, is just not good enough, right?
Yep.
And the team took a look at the ROI of what it would take to extend the feature and extend accuracy even more, and ultimately decided there were bigger, better opportunities to pursue. So we rolled the feature back and no longer exists. It's no longer out there. It certainly has informed, I think, a lot of how Stack Overflow thinks about AI in its products today. And I'll speak to another example in a minute here. But for us, even with all of that iteration, it didn't end up being something that we wanted to pursue long-term.
Yeah. I cannot share how much I love this. A lot of work went into this. It worked. You got to really good measurements and still there was a decision to roll it back. And I use so many products that have AI features that I wish they would roll them back because they don't really work. And I love that this is going to set the foundation for what happened next. This wasn't wasted effort. A lot of learning happened. And it allowed you to then look at what's the next thing, which we're going to get into next. But I think it's...
Yeah, I'll speak to that. I will mention the tech lead that was on that team. He recently said to me about 6 months ago, he said, I think we had to go through that because otherwise we would have never been able to get where we are. And that was a nice full circle moment. So I'll talk about the next example.
Yeah, I love that. Again, this new technology is going to force us to embrace prototyping. And sometimes we throw our prototypes away.
Yeah. In fact, we should.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So the next example, to give a little bit more context, let's move forward about 6 to 9 months. So we're talking kind of late 2023, early 2024. At the time, so Stack Overflow, because we have, I think, 14 million questions and answers that developers have written on the site, I quote that number quite a lot. It's a very large corpus of data, right? And we actually had some pretty heavy instrumentation on our site and a lot of relationships with AI providers within the space. And we started to see two things. One was that scraping of our site was off the charts, or attempted scraping of our site was off the charts. Essentially, AI providers were getting really excited to use our Q&A data in their models and in their training. The other insight was that some of those parties were coming directly to us and asking to purchase, or license rather, access to the data to include in their models, right? Which as a product person is a bit of a gift from heaven if you're going to develop a new product.
When someone's already coming to you saying, can right. I buy this
yeah,
from
exactly.
you?
Yeah. Essentially, I was tasked with how do we capitalize on this opportunity? What would that look like? So this was the seed of a data licensing business that Stack has built over the last 18 months, which I led from the product perspective. But what I'm going to talk about today is how we started to understand which data in our corpus mattered to which use case and how we built benchmarks that could be templatized to compare different large language models for evaluating which model was better or worse at answering technical questions. So thinking back to that first experience, helping others understand if they were good at actually the use case that we originally set out to solve for.
Yeah. Okay, I want to make sure I understand this context. Yeah. The foundational labs, I'm guessing, are mm-hmm. who came to you and said some of them were trying to scrape your data, some of them were actually trying to purchase, license the data. And Stack Overflow is, oh, okay, maybe there's a thing here. First of all, that also feels like it could have felt really competitive. So I'm curious about what you can share, and if you can't share, that's fine, around like how Stack Overflow even thought about this. Like, I could see the argument that, hey, here's a new revenue stream, but I can also see the argument of, does this just cannibalize what we offer through our service? So if there's anything you can share there, I would love some insight into that.
Yeah, I will say both views are present within the company and in the industry. And I probably, if you look back on the history of podcasts that I've been on, probably spoken about this a few times. But what I would typically say is that one of the things that was central for us is making sure we worked with partners where we could essentially build virtuous sort of cycles of community engagement. So the idea was that models didn't necessarily have the level of accuracy that were being advertised in the mm-hmm. market, particularly on technical Q&A. And if you think back to what I mentioned about the trust gap, developer expectations were a lot higher than the reality of the accuracy of those models.
Okay, I think a dot just connected in my brain, and I want to ask if I have this right. So you started to talk about you want to license your data to labs, and you were trying to evaluate if they were better at answering questions when they had your data.
Yep.
Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Oh, I love it. Okay, so from a product standpoint, you're thinking about, okay, we actually can license our data, and by doing so, we're going to help these labs answer questions better. And maybe to make sure they want to keep our data, we need to show that by licensing our data to them, they can answer technical questions better.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we would typically also work with them on product integrations, right? Where either they were driving traffic or engagement on Stack Overflow, so that we then start that knowledge creation process all over again.
Ah, okay. So then this gets at the, like, how does it not cannibalize your business?
Yep.
If you can show the labs that, like, hey, our answers make your answers better, but we're only going to license them to you if you have a mechanism that brings your user back to our site to contribute to knowledge creation.
Essentially, yeah.
Love it. Okay, let's
take a variety of forms. Like, it could take an enterprise-facing form or a developer tools-facing form, but that model was central to the tenet of the business.
Okay. Yeah. I love this. Okay. Let's dig into, I can imagine, I know we're going to have to go through this pretty quickly from a timeline standpoint, but I can imagine this also felt very urgent and a little bit scary. Tell me a little bit about just where did this idea come from? Like, how did you get to this model of we can license data, it will make their answers better, we can prove that, and we can get them to give us a feedback loop back?
Yeah, it was basically me testing through the process. So we started with, we know there's something there because there is demand for the data. So while AI labs and LLM builders weren't necessarily telling us what they were using data for, we had at least hypotheses about broad categories based on our own expertise. So that might be question and answer pairs, answering questions in a chatbot or other chat interface that were technical, as I mentioned earlier. We had a lot of signal that code completion, code generation were also potentially useful use cases that benefited from ingesting our data, given we don't have the code base of, say, GitHub, but we had quite a few code blocks within our data. And essentially, we just set out to figure out where we could prove out those use cases, right? So we essentially said, we know there's a black box. How do we open it? And it's maybe a metaphor of more of like shooting fish in a barrel, like until you figure out what the right answer is, you're testing into the right answer. But essentially so Stack Overflow is owned by a private equity group called Prosys. And I do want to give them due because they were instrumental in this example. So Prosys is half investment fund and half like operator. So they have a world-class AI lab and folks that are very well connected, world-class data scientists. So myself and a few of the data scientists on our team and the Prosys data science team sat down and I spelled out, these are the things that as prospects are coming to me, I'm hearing from them, right? So I'm hearing we want to improve search. I'm hearing that code completion is the use case that investors are deciding which coding tool is most relevant based on, right? Things like that. And where might we test whether our data can drive performance given those use cases? So I was bringing them back to the team and we were literally like playing around with things. Like we would be in a meeting and I would share ideas and they would say, okay, technical Q&A is probably the obvious place to start because that is Stack Overflow's core use case. And they would ask me like, are developers junior that are using this? And then I'd go back to the potential customer and I'd say, what do you think? And they'd share data with me. So it was this kind of continuous feedback cycle between the parties to get to an idea. So we ran a number of tests, but the one that I'll talk about today is actually the development of a technical benchmark, right? When you have a model, like a large language model like GPT-4 or Claude or name your model, and you ingest Stack Overflow data, does the performance of the model in answering a user's question get better when Stack Overflow knowledge is added on top? And I remember thinking back to the first example in a meeting. I remembered that when we've done those spreadsheet evaluations, is the answer right or wrong wasn't a sufficient way to look at it.
Getting back to your accuracy, completeness, right. Relevance. Yeah.
So accuracy being, is the answer accurate? Completion being, does it give all the necessary information and no more? And then relevance being like, is it relevant for this context?
Yeah.
Which can be programming language or enterprise in some cases or otherwise. And so we actually fine-tuned a few models based on Stack Overflow using that additional Stack Overflow data. And I think we use Llama 3 at that point.
Okay.
And because it was open source and we had full access to it. And we're able to say the performance of this model got, I can't speak to the exact numbers, but got this percent better.
Yep.
When you ingest Stack Overflow data.
Okay. And I want to just clarify, like when you say fine tuning, you mean you took an open source model and trained it using Stack Overflow data.
Yep.
So that the output was a model with different weights because of Stack Overflow's data.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know a lot of people are using fine tuning to mean things that are not fine tuning.
Good clarifier. It's very helpful. Yeah. I know there's a diverse audience here, so make sure you get everyone included.
I think also that's important because this is very different from RAG. Like you could, like Stack Overflow could have licensed their data to the labs through that RAG interface of you don't have the answer in your training data. We're going to go pull it live from Stack Overflow. But that's not what we're talking about. You're talking about licensing your data to the labs for the purpose of training.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Training or sometimes embedding in their products directly.
Yeah.
So it also would look like you have a search engine within your product. It can pull from Stack Overflow in addition to.
So that's more like the RAG example.
Yeah, exactly. We were able to prove that out with the Prosus team, right? We essentially saw accuracy, relevance, and completeness all go up.
Okay. I want to dig into this a little bit. You said you mentioned you created a benchmark. So just in case people aren't aware, but like every time a new model comes out, all the labs talk about how their model, their new model performed against this suite of benchmarks. Yep. And most benchmarks are just like, we can think about them like tests. Here's a bunch of inputs. Did you get the outputs right? What percentage of time did you get the outputs right? It sounds like Stack Overflow created a benchmark so that they could show, you could show when the model is trained on Stack Overflow data, you get X percent increase on our benchmark.
Yeah, so that was step one, right?
Okay.
Which was, this is a pretty complex example. Step one. And then step two, we started to use those that benchmark to evaluate models that didn't include Stack Overflow data and understand how they compare to each other.
Okay, I have a question though, because like right now my like science brain is really, alarm bells are going off. Like you wrote the benchmark you tested your product for. Like how did you not just overfit to your own test?
Yeah, so essentially we did a lot of work to prevent leakage.
Okay.
What that tended to look like, and I'm really simplifying down here, but what that tended to look like is we exposed all of the versions of the models that we were testing to questions that have and answers that wouldn't be publicly available to any of those models. So all of them were seeing that data for the first time when the benchmark was being created.
I'm assuming also as part of that, it means none of those questions were in the Stack Overflow data.
Correct.
Because that seems like the most concerning data leakage.
That's also correct. And then none of the models that were being evaluated from third parties included that data either previously.
And how did you, did you have to work with the labs on, how did you know that your benchmark, that none of your benchmark questions were included in the training lab model?
Essentially, we had enough like content that had been removed from our site.
Okay.
And that had validated answers or were in walled gardens that enabled us
to like maybe like enterprise.
Right, essentially.
Okay. Let me, I want to give people context because people may not understand this idea of leakage. And I think it's a really important one here. So when you're training a model or if you're doing any evals, anything, there's this idea of you have inputs you plan to use as your test to evaluate performance. And it's really important that like when you're writing your prompts, when you're doing your development, when you're doing your training, that nothing from the test leaks into the training. Otherwise, like the model will get good at the test because you trained it on the test. Right. And so the idea is that you're training on one set of data and you're testing on another set of data. And this is a theme that's going to come up a lot in this podcast and almost every conversation we have, this idea of like, how do we protect against data leakage is really critical. But I think in your case, because you're going to a third party and you're saying, look, if you include our data, you perform better on this benchmark we created. If I was that third party lab, I'd be like, you have got to convince me there was no leakage between your training and the benchmark.
Yeah.
So that's why in this case, it seems like usually the benchmark is created by a third party. And that's where you can have this idea of course, there's no leakage. Somebody else did it.
Yeah. And actually, one of the things I would do is I would share the data set that we use, and I would actually share the research paper.
Okay.
And
so full transparency in how you...
we created full transparency around it. And that actually usually did the trick.
Okay.
Because folks were, oh, this does help. And I do believe in these methods, right? Like, once you can start to poke holes in things, data scientists, much like developers, are healthy skeptics.
Yeah.
And they want to understand what's going on behind the hood. So it did need to stand up to that sort of technical scrutiny.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like version one, we have a benchmark. Right. We started with, for Llama, how does it perform against the benchmark without Stack Overflow data? Now we're going to train it with Stack Overflow data. How does it perform against the benchmark? I'm assuming you saw improvement.
Yep.
So then you started to move into, okay, now let's evaluate all the different labs. How do they do against the benchmark?
Yeah, exactly. And as we're thinking about the benchmark itself, right? It's important to remember, and this goes back to the earlier example, we were actually seeking out subject matter experts in each of those domains in the same way here to actually develop that benchmark so that it, we didn't want it to be like, oh, we created this thing that looks good in our marketing and therefore makes us look better. We wanted it to be highly validated, like, by subject matter experts in the industry. So those folks were helping us validate the correctness, the accuracy, and the relevance of the answers and rating those criteria. And we were taking in that process from the first example and using that same level of rigor to evaluate and score answers that would come through and then give those scores averages and compare the rankings for the different models. Yeah.
Oh, so you had subject matter experts evaluating the outputs. It wasn't just, here's a golden data set. This is the right answer. Did you get it or not?
Yeah, we had a golden data set that came from Stack Overflow. We also used subject matter experts to help validate the AI generated answers.
Yeah.
And then we implemented automated checks as a third step. So there were sort of three components here.
Okay.
Drive quality. Yeah.
This is a theme that's going to come up a lot as well. This idea of, yes, we can get to automated evals or automated benchmark in this case. But oftentimes, like, you only know your automations work if you can compare it to human labeled data. So you have to align them. Did you have multiple raters, like for your human raters? Were there multiple people rating the same question?
I forget the exact number, but I think we had about, we used a golden data set of about 250 questions that we refresh on a monthly basis. Think about our corpus as like a living, breathing thing.
Yep.
So we had to, as new content came out or ratings of content changed, we needed to include new contents and new weights to actually make sure that it, the benchmark was up to date. But yeah, I think we had about, we were about 10 to 15 folks that were looking at data. I can't remember if they were norming the same questions or just in their own domain, but certainly human involvement. Yeah.
So lots of human labeling.
Yeah.
The other thing you just said that I think is an important thing to highlight is that, like, you had a set of 250 questions that were like the basis of this benchmark, but they weren't static. They were evolving. And that's because the types of questions you would see people ask on the site were evolving. One thing, you're trying to keep it fresh and representative. I also imagine, like, with time, you're going to see overfitting to the benchmark. And so you want to see a diversity of questions and keep that always evolving. I know this is like a data science question. So if you don't know the details here, that's fine. I'm curious about what mechanisms did you use to determine what goes in that set, how to keep it fresh?
Yeah, this harks back to the first example or sort of the very first thing. In terms of freshness, I was typically using very basic indicators of quality, right?
Yeah.
So for those who aren't familiar with Stack Overflow, our users vote on answers and questions that they think are most relevant. We have what's called an accepted answer, meaning a sort of expert within our community has indicated it's as best fit. We have comments, which are not always used socially, they're used more technically. And then we have other activity data like page views. So I actually set up thresholds. How many page views does it have? What is the net score? How many answers does it have? So very, not basic, but simple measures of if these four or five things are all present, it's probably a pretty good question.
Okay.
We did that as the aggregate for the 250, and then we'd look within that group at the most recent data set for the last month or the last quarter. And we'd look at growth rate of page views in particular as kind of an indicator of that. Yeah.
I love that. You know what's great is that, like, this whole realm, it could have been like catastrophic for Stack Overflow. Right? This could have just destroyed Stack Overflow's business. And instead, what happened is it turned into a new revenue line. And you were able to get good at it because of all the things that make Stack Overflow good. Like, it's all those community signals that are feeding into how we're making this valuable for the labs.
Yeah. And I will say, like, one thing I do feel very lucky to have been in that position. And one thing I will say is that we used to talk to labs, and a couple potential customers did say to us something to the effect of, if you'd gone back 15 years and created a data set for LLMs on code, like, this would be the perfect data set.
Yeah.
Right. So many of the things that made it what it is today also made the data set really great for this use case.
It raises the question of, there's a lot of discussion right now about, once LLMs have consumed the whole internet, which they've already done, and we run out of data sources, like, maybe Stack Overflow is sitting on this model that is like the future of how do we get humans to fill in the gaps so that LLMs continue to grow? And there's already a pretty good foundation for that right over at Stack Overflow.
Yeah. That was my core thesis from a strategic perspective as a product leader.
Yeah, I got to say, as a content creator, that kind of gives me some hope that there's still a place for humans to contribute to the knowledge base.
Well, that's my hope, too.
Yeah. All right. Any last thoughts for either of these key lessons, things people should keep in mind?
I think one, we've talked about it quite a bit, but it's definitely a learning journey, right?
Yeah.
I definitely, what we've talked about in the last hour and a half is, starts with, we knew nothing and we put an interface on top of our search engine, all the way to we're advancing into building models and fine tuning models and creating industry level benchmarks. So that's a big journey. And so I think don't be afraid to start and figure it out along the way is one takeaway. The other I would say is, I think there's a fundamental shift here in how products get built. One of the things that I tell my teams is typically, you need to think about building products and evaluating products in probabilities rather than in certainties. And whether it be what you expect your product to do, how you expect your users to use the product, or the outcomes that you expect to drive, all of those things are now non-deterministic, right?
Yeah.
With the invention and injection of AI, and getting more comfortable with a range of outcomes rather than one certainty, I think is the biggest skill set that product managers need to take away in this next generation. So,
Yeah, I love this analogy of take one bite of the apple at a time. I think that is going to resonate with a lot of folks who've been on this journey. And then I think that second piece that you hammered on, this idea of like non-determinism, being comfortable with uncertainty, like, it turns out we always lived in that world, but LLMs just make it so much clearer that we live
in that
world.
It's like on steroids this time.
Yeah, it's on steroids for sure. Ellen, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for taking your time to do this.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe in your favorite podcast app and give us a rating, as it helps others find the show. Thanks. I appreciate it.